commit themselves to another form of jihad. Over here, it could be in the form of boycotts. It could be in the form of advocacy for the Palestinian people. So jihad in of itself can take a number of forms, and one of which inside of Palestine, a core component, is the armed struggle. And that's something, of course, which has been through a lot of Western propaganda, made out to be somewhat of what the concept of holy war against Jews or Christians or whatever. But really what this is inside of Palestine is a battle from the Palestinian people to defend their homes and to liberate their homeland, which is actually a right in the occupied territories under international law, which they are able to commit themselves to.
You make some really valid points there, Robert. And I want to bring in Sharifa on this now. Sharifa, just tell me about the activism that you've been doing for Palestine. Do you consider it to be a form of jihad as well?
I don't usually use that term, to be honest. But for me, of course, existing state violence, whether even in this country, with the police disproportionately killing people, like the black people, I feel like, you know, there's always going to be an uprising or resistance from communities that are heavily impacted by state violence, whether it's, for example, the Israeli occupation, or indigenous communities from like Canada to Australia, you know, to North America. There's always been people rising up to challenge their oppressor. And of course, I understand in the terminology that is used in this context that you're suggesting, yeah.
Now, Robert, Sharifa mentioned there that she doesn't normally use the term jihad when describing activism in support of Palestine that she engages in. And I think that there are many other people, Muslims included as well, that live in the West that would agree with that. They don't use the term very much. One of the reasons, quite possibly, would be because it's associated with things like extremism and terrorism, that type of thing. Unfortunately, that is the truth. It's become a kind of dirty word in the West, unfortunately. But it shouldn't be, should it?
No, I think it has been. And for instance, for myself, I don't use that term regularly because you have to understand your audience and who you're talking to. If you're talking to a Western audience who isn't familiar with the terminology, then they're going to interpret that as you being a fundamentalist takfiri who wants to commit side bombing. So they don't understand that if I use the term jihad to me as a Muslim, this means that I am struggling against oppression and that I am standing up for an oppressed community in work that I may do or that activists may do. So for us as Muslims, this is what this term means. But the meaning of the word has been robbed of us by Western media and its and the Western governments, their so-called war on terror, which was a war of terror against the Muslim peoples. And so, yes, it's become a dirty word. It's become associated with holy war and religious fundamentalism. And so, unfortunately, to use this terminology now for certain audiences is not going to get the reaction which we would hope, which, for instance, in advocacy work for talking about the Palestinian people, we want to try and help people understand what is happening there. And so, unfortunately, that term has been robbed from us.
That is very true. Now, Sharifa, let me ask you, because you've been to Palestine, you've seen what it's like there, and you've seen basically the Palestinian jihad, the fact that they're resisting an ongoing colonialist occupation. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that experience. What did you see?
For example, in Jenin refugee camp, which is also similar in Nablus and places, you've got Palestinians who are involved in armed resistance, you know, places where they've ensured that there's no checkpoints and ongoing from the Second Intifada. Like, even in Jenin, like, there was a lot of settlements that were there on the outskirts. They were removed during the Second Intifada. So even then, it's scary because at night people are sleeping. You'll just know that the army, the Jaish, they've come into the camp and people do resist, you know. There's innocent children that are killed, mothers. It's everyday people, so I don't really feel like you can separate the two, this idea of combatants and non-combatants, who's the innocent party. People have grown up around so much destruction, so much grief, so much, like, PTSD that's just ongoing. I feel, the same way, you know, you could go to a place like Bolivia and other countries as well, you see the same thing from people that are not Muslim. People are resisting as indigenous communities, and that is what it's going to be. Of course, in places like Jenin, you're going to have a large Muslim majority. You know, you've still got churches and stuff in Jenin, there's Christians. But at the same time, of course, people are going to identify with it in a certain way.
I'm gonna come back to Rob on this, because one thing I want to make absolutely clear is that obviously when it comes to Palestine, it's very easy to focus on resistance, the fighting, the killings, and the resistance against the colonialism, like the physical resistance to colonialism. But let's remember that jihad is also about, say, for example, just staying in the occupied territory, because it could, there are offers being made for Palestinians to sell their businesses, sell their homes, and to just go away. That's, I think, a major strategy of the Israeli regime. Just pay them to go away and take over slowly. However, the fact that they decide to stay, I think, is a type of jihad, because, again, they're still putting up with the struggle, but in order for the ultimate goal. Would you agree, Robert?
Yes, absolutely. It is a form of jihad for them to stay there, because especially if you are in places like the Jenin refugee camp right now, or in the old city of Nablus, you are going to struggle enormously. If you're in Area C of the West Bank, the chances are your house is going to be demolished, your entire village is going to be demolished. So for people there inside of the West Bank, for instance, in East Jerusalem as well, and even in the Gaza Strip, they're living through hellish conditions. In Gaza, we're looking at a population of 2.2 million people, 70%+ of which are refugees, and they're living in a space which, as of 2020, has been declared by the United Nations as unlivable. They don't have a clean drinking water supply. So this, for them to just remain there in of itself, is a form of jihad and a form of struggle against the Zionist entity. And of course, you know, the armed struggle is what often gets a lot of attention because they want to paint this as terrorism. But if we look at it in other contexts as well, all people who are suffering under settler colonial occupation have struggled and used armed struggle. There is nowhere you can find on earth where people have not used armed struggle against colonizers and against settlers, settler projects. There is no example. So in all of these examples, sure, people remaining there and using the armed struggle and all sorts of popular struggle is a form of jihad.
Well, self-defense, I think, is something condoned even in international law. Everyone has a right to defend themselves when attacked. Those are some very valid points, Robert. Now, earlier this week, we spoke to Palestinian journalist based in Gaza, Wafa al-Odaini, as a Muslim living under constant threat of war between Palestinian resistance and the Israeli regime. She explained how important the concept of jihad is amid the ongoing occupation of her people's land.
First of all, thanks for having me. Actually, you know, jihad means resisting the occupation, resisting the oppression, resisting the brutality of the occupiers. Actually, you know, as Palestinians, we're daily subject to Israeli occupation, subjugation, and atrocity. So this means that as the landowners, we have to defend ourselves. We have to confront the occupiers who came from outside Palestine, from different European countries, who came as militias in 1948, and then they kicked the Palestinians, who are the landowners, out of their homes, and then they took their homes. So it is really, you know, it is a must for every Palestinian here in occupied Palestine to resist this occupation by all means, not only armed resistance, but whether popular or for resistance and all kind of resistance, you know, because it is really very legal to confront and to stop this occupation, who their mission only to wipe us out of our land, to wipe us out as Palestinians out of the map, you know. So it is really, we consider jihad, who, you know, we know that they have like a misconception of jihad, and especially in the West. But indeed, as Palestinians, it is, you know, we can say it is equal to the word resistance here, as they understand it, you know. So as Palestinians, we do believe in jihad as a kind of confronting any occupiers to our land.
At the beginning of May, pro-Palestinian activists in the English city of Leicester embarked on their own form of jihad by besieging an Israeli arms factory. Elbit Systems supplies drones to the Israeli military as well as weaponry to the British armed forces. Protesters have vowed to shut it down.
Essentially, I believe it's a moral, social, religious responsibility for every single human being of conscience to stand with the oppressed wherever they are, particularly for us as British citizens. Inherently, the Zionist regime could not exist without imperialist support. That's the only reason that it exists, actually. And as British citizens, we have an extra added layer of responsibility because ultimately it was Britain that handed over Palestine like it was a piece of bread to the UN. It was a Balfour Declaration in 1917 that promised the Jews the inherent right to Palestine as though it was theirs to give. So ultimately, it's in the meeting point between the imperialists and the Zionists that the Zionist project was able to actualize. It was due to the imperialists. Without imperialist support, I must stress this, Zionist entity is unable. Today we're outside of Elbit Systems. Okay, this is very important. This activism has worked. Already, the protesters have managed to shut down the factory in Oldham. They've managed to shut down the headquarters in London. They've managed to basically cancel a £300 million contract with the Ministry of Defence. Because of these protests, ultimately, Elbit doesn't want to go to court because Elbit knows that it will be implicated in court, essentially. They don't want to reveal some of the secret activities that they have conducted, which, by the way, the Ministry of Defence knows about, the state knows about. It was the state that created the Zionist entity. And they will cover and they will stick up for their interests.
Well, there you have it. So an important battle taking place against Elbit Systems, a UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer. Sharifa, let me bring you back in on this because obviously you've been involved in the protest action there. Just tell me, why is it so important to keep this struggle against Elbit Systems going?
I think in general, it's just to ensure people don't forget that it exists over there, but at the same time to let Elbit know that communities, and not just Muslim communities, majority of the people that are doing actions against these factories are not even Muslim. And I think it's really important for people, for them to know that, you know, the same way when it came to people in South Africa stopping the boats during South African apartheid and other ways, that there is going to be like people that are going to make noise at key places that supply weapons and arm people that are occupying communities.
Robert, one thing that I find very interesting about this concept of jihad is it's linked to, by Western media outlets, it's linked to terror groups like Daesh, for example. But the Muslims who fought against Daesh and were responsible for defeating Daesh and other terrorist groups that have been prominent in the region for quite some time now, they were fighting a jihad against Daesh. We saw Iraqis, they declared fatwa against fighting Daesh and defeating them. So this was a Muslim religious jihad against Daesh, which won out. It wasn't American bombing campaigns which killed some civilians and some took theories, who knows, that won out the day. It was a Islamic World jihad against Daesh, which ultimately defeated them, if you agree. So again, it seems a real shame that jihad is associated with terrorism.
Yes, in fact, as well, when you look at these Takfiri groups, Al-Qaeda and Daesh, they are, in of themselves, they killed majority Muslims. These are the populations which they targeted, Muslim populations in Muslim countries. And most of the time, Western weapons and Western funding as well. This is another thing. And so when we're looking at these organizations, even Daesh and Al-Qaeda and these sorts of Takfiri organizations in the Gaza Strip have attacked Palestinians there. They've attacked Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And so there's often this conflation between those sort of groups and then groups which are fighting for national liberation, which are completely separate. Hamas has nothing to do with Daesh, and it's not even comparable. Same with other groups like Hezbollah. They were created to liberate their own territory. So for them, again, they fight their own form of jihad in their contexts. So talking about the word jihad, it's been robbed of all of its value, if you're going to use this word in a context, in the Western context.
Now, we've established that. I think you and I have both come to an agreement that the term has become a dirty word. Unfortunately, in the Western world, it has been robbed of its real meaning. But what I want to ask you is, who do you think is responsible for that more so? Because obviously there's the Western world. They do what the Western world does. Western propaganda has been targeting Muslims indiscriminately for a very long time, trying to spin words like Islamist, jihadists, to give them negative connotations. That's normal. But what I wonder is perhaps Muslims living in the West haven't done enough to safeguard and defend these concepts and hit back, say, no, jihad doesn't mean terrorism, it doesn't mean holy war. Actually, it's a positive word about which Muslims do all the time. They are trying to benefit and improve themselves, seek closeness to Allah, seek closeness to Islam. You know, jihad and all this stuff, like jihadists, Islamists, they're meaningless words which are far from the actual reality on the ground. So do you think that perhaps Muslims are partly to blame for this?
Well, I think the definitions are not known. What is an Islamist? I mean, this is a very broad term. It can mean a good thing. I could be described as an Islamist. So it's and many people can. So when we're talking about the terminology, I think now, at this current time, Muslims can speak up more and be heard when they're talking about these issues. And I think there is a reluctance from some Muslims to talk about these this terminology and these terms and blame them because they're still afraid. But if we're talking back in 2003, when the United States and this country are invading Iraq, there was no space for this sort of dialogue in the Muslim community. There was a concerted campaign which was specifically designed to demonize the Muslim world and to justify killing Muslims and persecuting Muslims. That's what they did. They killed millions of Muslims in the Middle East. And this campaign that they designed was multifaceted. So part of it was a media campaign. Part of it was owning the terms. Part of it was cracking down on Muslim organizations like the Holy Land Foundation, which did nothing wrong, by the way, inside of the United States, and unjustly going after people who were doing charitable work. So back then, I don't believe Muslims could have done a great deal to change the popular perception, because we're mentioned as Muslims on the news on a daily basis. But who can tell us the five pillars of Islam? Who can tell you the difference between Sunni and Shia? Nobody knows this. Most people think that Iranians, Afghans, and Arabs are the same people. So there is a lack of understanding. And now we have a space, I think, in this day and age, right now, to speak up more on this. But in the past, I think it was very difficult.
Absolutely. Now, Sharifa, let me bring you back in once again. We haven't got long left of the show, so I'll give you a chance to educate our audience about the type of action, which I think has become a lot more popular, particularly among Muslims, but also non-Muslims as well, which is direct action. Another example would be, I guess, the BDS campaign as well, which has become very popular, I think, and has achieved some major gains. Could you just explain, do you think that this is the future of activism in support of Palestine, this direct action route?
I think it is effective. Like, there's people that stand up against the Barclays Bank and, you know, highlight their crimes and their support for the Israeli occupation. So I think, you know, people taking a more drastic or, like, in ways that are, like, quite capturing in it from the media as well, for people to actually observe. Like, you know, it's until Pal Action actually brought it to our local community in 2021, where six people were on the roof of a factory outskirts of Leicester. No one knew about this.
Absolutely. And Rob, we literally just have a few moments left of the show. So just very quickly summarise, jihad, of course, is a religious obligation for Muslims. So again, I think in support of Palestine, we're obliged to show more support.
Yes, absolutely. And if you're outside of Palestine, obviously the armed struggle is not an option for you to participate in, and it is illegal in these countries. And of course, Israel is not there. So in this context, it makes no sense. I think things like, for instance, not buying Israeli dates. If you're a Muslim and you have a business over here, why are you selling Israeli dates? I saw this during Ramadan myself, that Muslim businesses were selling Israeli dates. This is something that Muslims over here should do, is boycott action, or just raising awareness if you don't have the ability to do anything else to talk about these issues and to engage with your community on these issues. I think it's very important. And over here, this is perhaps one of the strongest forms of jihad.
Absolutely. Well, thank you to both my guests. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you in the studio, Robert, and to Sharifa. Thank you for joining us online as well. But that's all the time we have for this edition of Eye on Islam. Thank you at home for watching as well. But join us again next week as we will be back for another edition of the show. Assalamu alaikum for now.
فیلم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. Please stay tuned.
شامتن به مصیبتن کسانی که مردم رو در مصیبت و گرفتاری ها شما
امام صادق علیه السلام quotes امام الباقر علیه السلام stating leave companionship with the people who blame others in their hardships and afflictions since they will one day blame you in front of others like they blame others in front of you. It is also mentioned in our hadith collection that one day a blamer will be blamed for his actions too. Thus, we are recommended not to be happy when witnessing the failure or affliction of others.
فرمودن به شکست دیگری خوشحال نشو احتمال بده ور شکسته فردا تو باشی.
Thus, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is stating that we must not be happy with the breakdown or bankruptcy of others. It is probable that in the near future we become bankrupt or we face a big failure. As a result, companionship with the blamer has severe negative effects in our lives. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us, the Ahlul Bayt, and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
In the limelight.
In the United States, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu says Donald Trump is a four-time loser who will not necessarily be the Republican presidential nominee. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu said on Sunday, 23rd of April, that Republicans want someone who can win as their presidential candidate, adding that former President Donald Trump lost the past three elections for the GOP. Republicans want someone who can win in November of 2024. Donald Trump is a loser. He had not just lost once. He has lost us our House seats in 2018, Sununu said. He lost everything in 2020, and we should have 54 U.S. senators right now, and we don't, because of his message. So Donald Trump is positioning himself to be a four-time loser in 2024. Chris Sununu said that while Republicans have rallied behind the former president as he faces multiple investigations, that support may not actually translate into a vote. He noted that voters do not know who they are voting for 3 weeks before the election, saying that other candidates will enter the race and debates will need to be held to determine who will be the Republican nominee. "You know you can't govern if you don't win," Sununu said. And again, so he drags that ticket down, he added, referring to Donald Trump. "I think that really is going to really come to bear through the primary process. So I understand folks are supporting him. They think that a lot of the stuff with the district attorney is political, which I believe it is too, by the way." Chris Sununu said that Donald Trump plays the victim card, but Republicans want someone who's going to fight for them. And the governor said the former president did not follow through on his campaign promises, like building a border wall with Mexico and reforming health care. "Republicans want someone who's going to fight for them, but we also want a fighter that can win." He said he was going to go to Washington and drain the swamp. "He didn't do it," Sununu said. He said he was going to build a wall and secure things. "He didn't do it." He said he was going to give us health care reform and be fiscally disciplined, not add $8 trillion to the debt. "He didn't do any of those things. And so we want fighters that can actually win and take accountability." Chris Sununu had previously said that Donald Trump will not be the nominee, saying that that is not going to happen. When asked on Sunday, 23rd of April, when the governor is expected to make a decision on whether he will run for president, Chris Sununu dodged that question, saying, "Everybody will have to make a decision by 4th of July. The website of businessinsider.com has also covered this story and tells us more. Despite rising support for former President Donald Trump in his race for re-election, the Republican governor of New Hampshire remains skeptical. Donald Trump is a loser, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu told NBC's Chuck Todd on Meet the Press on Sunday, 23rd of April. When Florida Governor Ron DeSantis hasn't officially announced a bid for the presidency, he seemed like a potential rising star for Republicans in 2024. That star has dimmed of late, however, as several lawmakers in his own state have thrown their support behind Donald Trump. Despite the momentum now behind Trump, Chris Sununu said he doesn't think the former president has the nomination locked up, especially as Trump faces 34 felony counts for falsifying business records in Manhattan. There's definitely a shift, but I still don't think he's necessarily going to be the Republican nominee, Chris Sununu said on Sunday, 23rd of April. Republicans are rallying. They're supporting former President Trump over these indictments, right? And there's a lot of support there. Chris Sununu said those displays of support may not actually translate into votes in favor of Trump as the Republican nominee, adding that the Republican Party wants a winner. Republicans want someone who can win in November of 2024. Donald Trump is a loser. He has not just lost once, Sununu said. He has lost us in our House seats in 2018. He lost everything in 2020. We should have 54 U.S. senators right now, but we don't because of his message. So Donald Trump is positioning himself to be a four-time loser in 2024. Chris Sununu himself is considering a potential 2024 presidential candidate and has teased the possibility, though he has yet to make any formal announcement. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story. Donald Trump is a four-time loser who will not necessarily be the Republican presidential nominee despite dominating primary polling, the New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu said on Sunday, 23rd of April. Donald Trump is positioning himself to be a four-time loser in 2024, Chris Sununu said. We need candidates that can win. A Republican governor in a Democratic part of the country and of a key early voting state, Chris Sununu is seen as a potential candidate in the moderate lane, should such a lane still exist, in a Republican Party dominated by Donald Trump. Speaking to NBC's Meet the Press program, Chris Sununu was confronted by comments to the same network just 2 months ago when he said Donald Trump was not going to be the Republican nominee. We're just moving on as a party, as a country, Sununu said back in February. He's not going to be the Republican nominee. That's just not going to happen. Here's the good news. You're dead wrong. He's not going to be the nominee. Since then, particularly since Donald Trump was this month arraigned on criminal charges in New York relating to his hush money payment to the film actress Stormy Daniels, the primary paradigm has shifted. Trump dominates polling, expanding his lead over Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor who has not declared a run, and other actual or likely candidates. Donald Trump also faces legal jeopardy over his election subversion and incitement of the 6th of January 2021 attack on Congress, his handling of classified materials, his business and tax affairs, and a civil rape case against him due to go trial in New York next week. He denies wrongdoing and claims victimization by Democrats. On Sunday, NBC released an opinion poll in which a fraction under 70% of Republicans agreed with him. Chris Sununu told NBC's Meet the Press, there had definitely been a shift, but insisted, I still don't think he's necessarily going to be the Republican nominee. Look, I think your poll is spot on in all of these areas. I think that's actually a great poll. I hope folks listen to it. And at the end of the day, we want a winner, right? Republicans want someone who can win in November of 2024. Donald Trump is a loser. He has not just lost once. He has lost us our House seats in 2018. He lost everything in 2020. And we should have 54 US senators right now. But we don't, because of Donald Trump's message. So Donald Trump is positioning himself to be a four-time loser in 2024. We need candidates that can win. Many within and without Republican ranks are questioning whether Ron DeSantis is that sort of a candidate. The Florida governor has fallen away in polling, experiencing problems, including a pause by a major donor who said he was turned off by hard right policies, including school book bans and a 6-week abortion ban. Thomas Petoffi, an online trader, did not say he would not support Ron DeSantis at all, but he also gave $1 million to the Virginia governor, Glenn Youngkin, who has not declared a run. On Sunday, Rolling Stone quoted a source formerly allied to Ron DeSantis, but now in the Trump orbit, as saying, if Ron DeSantis thinks the last couple of months have been bumpy, he's in for a painful ride. As Florida Republicans in Congress have endorsed Donald Trump, so DeSantis has come under fire for an alleged lack of personal warmth. Rolling Stone described an evolving attempt by Donald Trump to trash his rival personality as well as politically. The unnamed source said the nature of the conversations among the people who used to work for Ron DeSantis is just so frequently, okay, how we can destroy this guy. It is not at all at a level that is normal for people who hold the usual grudges against horrible bosses. It's pure hatred that is much, much purer than that.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer the questions that you have related to the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad. May peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor, we have a question from a 14-year-old boy, a very strange question. His name is Zahran Han, and he's from Islamabad, Pakistan. And he's saying that I go to a British school in Pakistan, and I live in a very liberal family, but my family is so liberal in their conversations that I sometimes feel uncomfortable. I want some of the tips and advices. Thank you so much.
Yes, so we need to know what he means by liberal. if they're talking about things which normally people do not talk about. And especially in Pakistani society, it's quite a conservative society. And therefore, normally you don't open up with your children, even between yourselves, about such things. So if he thinks, if the parents are talking about things which they think are important for him to know as a young person.
Professor, well, we actually received this question in the holy month of Ramadan, and it said that whosoever Allah wishes to guide, he guides him. And it seems that this boy, a 14-year-old, has actually opened up, being liberal in brackets. He means that his parents have encouraged their children being friends with the opposite sex, and that's what he means by being liberal, while as this child himself feels uncomfortable and he wants some guidance. And this question we received in the holy month of Ramadan, and today we had the opportunity to use.
So it doesn't mean that the liberal in the sense that I would like to understand that maybe they're talking about things which are important and he should know about them as something which is a normal thing which we think should be done by parents, which it is not, especially in conservative societies like Pakistan. Parents do not talk about these things with their children, and they leave it to the whims of the society to let them know about such things, especially in the age of social media where everything is on the net and you can't, you know, stop anything from coming. You can't filter. But yes, in certain elite sections of our society where they're so much open-minded, there are no limits to the relationships between men and women and all that, and they are talking in such a way which seems to be offensive and vulgar, then of course that is the situation he needs to tackle. Number one, he should be able to it would be difficult for him to be able to talk to his parents, to talk them out of talking in such a way, because the moment he starts talking that way, they would become really apprehensive that he's now going down the mullah's path.
Yeah.
So that is a very difficult situation, and we find in such situations, parents become very concerned that a child
is feeling modest, actually going down the mullah's path.
Of course, if their mindset is such that society should
so
be open.
So they will think like that, basically.
They will, of course, think that he's going down the mullah's path. And so that is the important thing that he needs to understand, that if he starts, he can only avoid such situations where he's being forced to think such a way.
Yeah.
So he needs to balance the situation. Either he just he understands that what they're saying is not correct, then himself he should, you know,
take decisions, right?
Be independent in his own behavior and his own decisions.
Yeah, Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIV English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we are talking about a 14-year-old who feels uncomfortable with the liberal and open kind of environment he has in the family. So yes, Professor, you were helping us that he should be, if he's able to make independent decisions, then he should be able to manage. He should be managing and controlling himself.
Yes, Joe, he should, there are two issues. If he is himself being forced to do something which is wrong, that is one thing. And number two, he wants them to change their opinion. He wants to make them realize that they're making a mistake. These are two things.
Yeah.
So if he can show his independence and he makes his own decision and makes them feel that he is not going to budge from that position and he's going to take care of the Islamic principles and the values of Islam, and he makes them realize that you may say whatever you want, but I can't. I'm responsible to you. I'm answerable to you. I am going to follow your commands, but with this condition that they do not conflict with the commands of Allah Almighty.
All right.
So yes, we need to obey our parents, but the condition, the major condition is, the most important condition is that their commands do not conflict with the commands of Allah.
Yeah.
If they want him to do something which is wrong in the eyes of Allah, then he should clearly say to them that I am not allowed to do so by virtue of my religious principles and values. So as far as his own behavior goes, he needs to protect himself from such a situation and not accepting their inclinations or their what they desire. As far as this keeping to his position and keeping to maintaining his independence may make them realize that they're making a mistake. But if that does not happen and they continue on this path, then he needs to take advice from people who can help him and assist him in talking and maybe allowing them to talk, he gets to a situation where he is able to make senior people come to his house and talk to his parents and to maybe senior ulama or learned people, wise people, elderly people who can make his parents realize that they're making a wrong decision and they are doing something which is wrong and Islam does not want that to happen.
Yeah. So what is important is that 14-year-old is not, we won't say he's that young or he's not either too old, but you are giving some of the tips and advices that he can actually manage things, he can actually balance the things, and today there's a world of internet, he can actually guide himself on Islamic principles and Islamic sayings, so that may Allah enlighten his heart and also the heart of his parents, and also give them the sense that there's a balance between being open and being modest with our children. Well, Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th Surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we have Professor Salman Naqvi with us. We are discussing about the parents who are kind of more open and liberal to their children, and sometimes it's their children who do not feel very comfortable. So is it okay to be that open, or Professor has something more to say? Yes, Professor.
Yes, one of the issues nowadays that we're facing in society in general, and especially all over the world, but especially in Islamic society, is that there's a feminist movement going on, especially a feminist movement where they're talking about their rights. And they profess and they claim that it's my body and I have all the rights over it. I can do whatever I like with my body. In Urdu, they say, "Mera jism, meri marzi."
My body, my choice.
My body, my choice. So these are the slogans being given there. So unfortunately, it's not a good situation, and many many so-called liberal, open-minded people are also, even men folk, are joining in with this voice of, unreason. It's not the voice of reason. We need to understand that all of us, we belong to Allah Almighty. Whatever we have is Allah has given us. Our body is a trust with Allah from Allah Almighty.
And we will be questioned tomorrow.
And we will be answerable to Allah Almighty about it. So we cannot deal with ourselves or with anybody based on our own whims and our own feelings and what we think is right. So this open society which is there today, we need to confront it in a very logical way. Of course, unfortunately, sometimes why do they think that it's the mullah's way or it's the mullah's path instead of saying that it's Allah's path?
All right.
It's sometimes because we, the ulama, the scholars, religious scholars, try to portray themselves as those who are the stakeholders in this issue. They have personal gains to benefit from in this situation.
All right.
The society feels that they are they want to keep their influence and their power by imposing their will upon others.
Yeah.
Whereas actually it's not their own will, it's the will of Allah, it's the path of Allah, it's the way of Allah that has to be imposed on society. So it depends on how we talk to our society. If they see that we are looking for example, a special position in society as ulama, as religious scholars, then of course they will be offended and they will think that we are looking for some special position in society. No, we should make them realize and they should understand that whatever we as religious scholars or ulama are claiming or professing, it's not our personal opinion. It is something which God says very explicitly. It's not what something is, which it's not a matter of interpretation. Some commands of Allah Almighty are very clear, and especially about modesty.
Explicit.
It's very explicit.
Well, what is important is that both parents and children got to be educating themselves over Islam, and being open-minded does not always mean to be anti-Islamic. In fact, the more Islamic behavior you have, the more open-minded you are, because Islam is a complete religion which guides us on each and every topic of our life. We have Quran that talks about science, education, everything, psychology, health, history, and many more things. So what's important is to educate ourselves, both as parents and also as children. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.